For me, I couldn't care less. By the time Frecky came back to the table, their ice cream had been served. Are you two getting to know each other? Mike Monsky smiled a small, wry smile.
You might say that.
Then he turned to Miri.
How's your ice cream?
She hadn't tasted it yet. She lifted her spoon, dipped her tongue into it, and said, It's fine.
How's Rusty?
He asked. She's fine. She was wondering if he was going to go through the whole family.
I'm glad to hear that.
He swirled his ice cream around, blending the scoop of chocolate with the scoop of vanilla, like a little kid with a Dixie cup at a birthday party.
So, you're 15 now?
Why, did you forget when you shtupped my mother? Frecky sucked in her breath. Shtupped, a word she'd never said aloud until then. A vulgar word, Irene would say.
What did you do for your birthday?
He asked, ignoring her question. Had a pizza party with my girlfriends. My grandmother baked the birthday cake.
Ah, Irene, he said. She was a great baker.
So he knew Irene well enough to have tasted her cakes? My mother gave me this. She held up her wrist to show off her birthstone bracelet.
Very nice, he said.
Uncle Henry picked up the pizza at Spirito's. He's a famous reporter now.
So I've heard.
He better not ask if she had a boyfriend. She'd throw her ice cream at him if he did. Because she had the power, she realized. She could do whatever she damn well pleased. And if he thought she couldn't because he was her father, ha!
I live in California, he said,
tapping out an old gold cigarette. Same brand as his sister, she noticed. Or maybe Frecky had bought the carton and he'd filched a pack.
Los Altos.
She must have given him a blank look, because he added,
San Francisco Bay Area. This is my first trip back since I enlisted.
He fumbled around in his wallet and pulled out a picture.
My wife and sons, he said. Your half-brothers.
She didn't want to look, but she couldn't help herself. The boys were little, maybe 4 and 6. The wife was blonde, pretty. Not put-together pretty like Corinne, but casual pretty. She was younger, with chubby cheeks, wearing capri pants and a shirt. Posed like a movie star, leaning back against a tree with one foot on the ground and the other leg bent at the knee, her foot up against the tree, making it look as if the bottom half of that leg were missing. Miri passed the photo back without commenting.
Jeffrey and Josh, Frecky said. Those are your brothers' names.
What's your wife's name? Miri asked Mike Monsky.
Adela.
Adela? What kind of name is that?
It's an old family name.
Is she Jewish?
That's a personal question, Miri, Frecky said.
I thought we were getting personal.
She's half, but we're raising the boys Jewish, Mike Monsky said. I work in my father-in-law's business.
As if she cared enough to ask, what business? He told her anyway. She knew he would.
Shoe stores, he said. He's got a chain of shoe stores.
Did that mean Mike Monsky was rich? As if he could read her mind, he added,
He's got 2 sons working in the business, besides me. We were all in the Pacific together.
Uncle Henry was in the war. He got shot in the leg.
I'm sorry to hear that, Mike Monsky said.
How about you? Miri asked. Did you get shot?
No, I was lucky.
Rusty says they used to call you lucky. This was a complete lie. She didn't know why she said it.
Really? I never heard that.
Neither did I, Frecky said. Lucky you didn't get caught getting someone pregnant before Rusty. She was getting in too deep now.
That's a joke, right?
Mike Monsky asked. She shrugged. If you say so.
My daughter's got a great sense of humor, Mike said to Frecky,
who just shook her head. Then he turned back to Miri and smiled. She didn't want to like his smile, but she did.
"Please stop calling me your daughter," she told him. "You don't know me."
"You're right, but I hope I'll have the chance to remedy that."
Freki looked at her watch.
"I don't want to break this up, but I've got to get home. We have company coming for dinner."
"Don't forget," she reminded Mike. 7:30, in a tie and jacket."
"Go ahead," Mike Monsky told Freki. "I'll make sure Miri gets home safe and sound, and I'll see you later."
"Take the Cadillac." Freki passed her car keys to him.
"I'll take the Buick."
In the car, he turned on the radio. Pete Seeger and the Weavers were singing "So Long, It's Been Good to Know You," a song that perfectly described her feelings about today. She bet he was sorry he'd turned to that station. Maybe he did it so he wouldn't have to talk to her on the drive home. Maybe it was to save her from having to talk to him. When they got close to Sayre Street, she told him to drop her off 2 blocks away, where there was less danger of Rusty or Irene seeing her in the car with him. He turned off the ignition and faced her.
"You should know," he said. "I changed my last name to Monk when I married Adela. My sister doesn't know, and I'd appreciate it if you didn't tell her. I'd like to be the one to break the news."
"Why are you telling me?"
"You know why. Because you're my daughter."
She bristled.
"It would be your last name, too."
"My last name is Ammerman."
"You know what I mean."
He reached for her hand. For 1 second, she looked into his eyes and saw her own. Then she pulled her hand away, jumped out of the car, and ran for home. Later, she remembered the way his hand had felt, warm and strong.
"My father," she thought. "That asshole was my father."
She reminded herself not to like him, reminded herself he'd abandoned Rusty before she was even born. She didn't know if it happened that way, but she assumed it had.
"He planted the seed, then he flew the coop."
She vaguely remembered Rusty telling her that when she was small and asking about her daddy. She had no idea what it meant at the time. She'd imagined a chicken sitting on an egg. Now she heard Irene's voice in her head. "You can't trust the Monskys." And it was true, wasn't it? Freki had tricked her. And who was this guy who called himself her father, really? He could be anybody. His stories could all be invented. No, she would not allow herself to like him. Rusty and Irene wanted to hear about her day with Freki. She told them about the restaurant, the show, ice cream at Grunning's, but she didn't mention Mike Monsky. Seeing him was her latest secret. Elizabeth Daily Post, Park and Spark, January 31st. In this so-called modern age of the hot rod and snazzy car, the problem of teenagers parking seems to be a big one for parents. But a smart girl will realize that if her popularity hinges on Park and Spark, it will be short-lived. There's a price to be paid for free and easy necking. Girls know what a horrible nightmare a girl with a bad reputation must live through. Chapter 18. Christina. Christina wasn't thrilled about going on a double date with Mason and Miri, but Jack wanted to do this for his brother, so she would do her best to make sure a good time was had by all. It wasn't that she didn't like spending time with Mason, and she had nothing against Miri, though she knew her only from Dr. O's office and as Natalie's friend. It was about not wanting to give up her time alone with Jack. She'd missed her chance last night because she'd had to go with her family to an engagement party for her least favorite of the cousins who worked at Three Brothers. There would be no time to go to Jack's room tonight, something she'd been doing lately. Jack wasn't allowed to have overnight guests, wasn't allowed to entertain women in his room, so he had to sneak her in, which wasn't that hard. Mrs. O'Malley knew her now and understood she wasn't Jack's sister.
But she also knew Christina was a good girl from a good family, and that Jack was not going to take advantage of her, so she was willing to look the other way if she caught a glimpse of Christina going up the stairs. It wasn't as easy with Christina's mother. If Christina was unable to be home by 11:30 p.m., she had to call and explain why. And it had better be a good excuse, like a snowstorm, something Mama could see for herself. As far as Mama knew, she was going to the movies with a group of friends tonight, which was almost the truth. She didn't add that the movie was playing in Newark, or that it was The Thing, which they'd missed when it first came out last spring. Miri. "What's going on?" Rusty asked Miri. "Why are you dressing up?"
"Mom, I told you, I'm going on a double date tonight."
"On a Sunday?"
"Yes, because Mason had to work late last night. We're going with Christina and Jack."
"Who are they?"
"Mason's brother, Jack, and Christina from Dr. O's office."
"Christina goes with Mason's brother?"
"Yes, Jack McKittrick."
Why couldn't Rusty keep any of this straight?
"How old is Jack?"
"I don't know. Maybe 21 or 22.
"I don't want you going out with someone that old."
"Mom, Christina and Jack are the chaperones. You know Christina from Dr. O's office."
"She seems like a responsible girl," Rusty said, more to herself than to Miri.
"Yes.
Daisy says good things about her."
"See? And she's going to work for Dr. O full-time next year."
"Where are you going? That is, if I give you permission to go."
"To see The Thing."
Here it comes, Miri thought, bracing herself.
"The Thing? I don't want you to see that movie. It's a horror movie. You won't sleep for a week."
She could have said, "It can't be anywhere near as scary as the real things I've seen."
But she didn't. Rusty had the power to send her to her room and keep her there. Instead, she argued,
"Mom, please. It's just a movie. It came out last year. It's science fiction. Everyone at school has seen it, even the teachers."
This last part was a stretch. "I'll bet Christina would choose a different movie."
"Yeah, some love story, probably. You want me to see that kind of movie with Mason?"
"No, I do not." Miri decided to change the subject.
"And then we'll probably stop for burgers."
"Not at the White Castle. They serve horse meat."
"That's just something Nana said to scare you when you were young."
"No, it's the truth. During the war, they used horse meat."
"Well, the war is over."
What happened to happy-go-lucky Rusty from last weekend? Korea isn't over.
"That doesn't mean they still serve horse meat."
An image of Natalie at summer camp, astride a sleek black horse, popped into her head. "No burgers at the White Castle," Rusty said. "Do you understand?"
"Okay, no burgers at the White Castle."
"How are you getting there?"
"Jack has a truck. He's a very safe driver."
"How do you know?"
"Because he uses it to get to work. He's an electrician. Christina says he's the best."
"Ha! She's no judge if she's in love. You tell him you're my only child."
"He knows."
"How does he know?" What was this, the Spanish Inquisition?
"Okay, I'll tell him."
"And I want you home by 10. It's a school night, after all. And get all your homework done first."
"I'm almost done with my homework."
Something was making Rusty act crazy tonight. Maybe she was getting her period. Maybe she had a spirit living inside her, too, like Natalie. Maybe it was only a matter of time before the dead moved into all their bodies. Rusty came in for a hug. Surrounded by her familiar mom scent, Miri thought,
"There's so much I wish I could tell you, Mom, but I can't."
The movie wasn't as bad or as scary as she'd thought. After, at the White Castle, Miri ordered only fries and a Coke, while the others ate hamburgers. She didn't warn them about eating horse meat. They'd laugh at her, she knew, so she explained that she wasn't that hungry, probably because of the roast chicken Irene had served for Sunday dinner. Jack picked up the check for all of them. Jack was proud of his 48 Dodge panel truck, keeping it clean and in good shape, his equipment stored in fitted wooden boxes. Marian Mason sat on a little rug on the floor in the back and necked on the way home, sometimes falling over when the truck took a turn, making them laugh. Once, Christina slid open the little window between the front and back to look in on them.
"What's going on? Are you two okay?"
"We're fine," they said at the same time.
"You're sitting up?"
Christina asked.
"Like soldiers in a row,"
Mason said, tightening his fingers around Miri's. Jack and Christina dropped Mason and Miri off at her house. It was too cold to sit outside on the steps, so they crept down to the basement, something they'd done a couple of times before. It was dark and dank, even though Henry had painted the walls and the floor in a pale blue color, and the oil burner kept it warm. A single bulb on a pull string gave them light. Piles of cartons were neatly stacked, along with summer furniture for the porch. They sat together on a beach chair until it collapsed, sending them both to the concrete floor, laughing. After that, they unwound a summer rug and lay down on it. The sisal was itchy, but it would have been a lot itchier if they weren't fully dressed. They had to be very quiet, had to whisper. Miri wasn't sure what would happen if they were discovered. Henry would probably be okay with it, and Irene never came to the basement. But Rusty, she never knew with Rusty.
"Let's play Trust," Mason said.
"How do you play?"
"You've never played Trust?"
"No, I've never even heard of it. Is it a board game?"
He took her hand and smiled.
"You tell me something you've never told anyone else. Then I tell you."
"You tell me first," Miri said.
He turned toward her, propping himself up on an elbow.
"My mom,"
he began. He'd never told her anything about his parents. He'd never mentioned either one of them, except to say the kaleidoscope had been his mother's. She figured they were dead, or he wouldn't be living at Janet Memorial Home.
"My mom," he began again. "She took off after my dad slugged her so hard he knocked out her front teeth and broke her nose and cheekbone. She said next time he'd kill her. 'I'll come back for you, Mason,' she promised, the night she came to my room holding a small suitcase. 'I'll come back for you, and we'll go away together.' I was 11, and I believed her. Instead, they found her on the railroad tracks the next day. She either fell or jumped, and the train rolled over her. At the time, nobody bothered to tell me. Easier if I didn't know, they thought. Jack finally told me. He said it was an accident, but I think she jumped."
Miri didn't know what to say.
"Before she left," Mason continued, "she lay down next to me on my bed and said, 'He won't hurt you. He'd never hurt you. You just stay out of his way when he's drinking. Get out of the house. Go with Jack. Go anywhere. Just get out of his way.' I ran the night he came after me with an axe, picked up Fred, and got the hell out of there. That's the night Jack took me to Janet."
Miri could not stop the hot tears. She covered her face.
"Hey, come on. Don't,"
Mason said.
"It's okay."
She shook her head.
"It's not okay."
"Yeah, it is. Look, I'm here, aren't I?"
He kissed away her tears. Then it was her turn. What could she possibly confide that was anything compared to his story? How simple her life was next to his? How easy? She had just one secret to share with him. "My mom was never married. The guy who got her pregnant with me, his name is Mike Monsky, and the day I got my hair cut, I met him. My mom doesn't know. No one does except my aunt, an aunt I never knew I had." There. She'd said it. She didn't call him her father, because he didn't even know her, had never taken care of her, had never even seen a baby picture of her. What kind of father would that be?
Better than one who chases you with an axe, she thought.
But it's still cutting you up inside, isn't it? Part 3. February to April, 1952. Give her something special for Valentine's Day. Nia's Lingerie, featuring the finest in sleepwear. Elegance is our motto. Broad Street, Elizabeth. Chapter 19. Christina. Christina was at the store, helping her mother and sister get ready for Valentine's Day. They would soon be hosting a special evening for gentlemen only to choose gifts for their wives, even their girlfriends. Nia wasn't crazy about the idea, but Athena convinced her to give it a try. "Stop worrying, Mama. The merchandise can only be returned for store credit, so we can't lose." But it won't be returned, because a wife would never insult her husband, who went to all this trouble to please her. Believe me, she'll wear it, even if it's something she wouldn't normally be caught dead in.
"Unless she dies of embarrassment," Nia said, "then she'd be caught dead in it."
"Are you making a joke, Mama?" Athena asked. "Of course she's making a joke," Christina said. "Isn't that right, Mama?" Nia just shook her head at her daughters. Athena was counting on the gentlemen's desire to see their wives in black negligees, the younger ones especially, but also the ones whose old-world wives wore black every day, though never at bedtime.
"Black!" Nia screamed, pretending to faint, as Athena unpacked lacy black nightgowns. "Who would sleep in something black?"
She blamed Athena's bad judgment on the pregnancy. On the day that Athena brought in a window dresser to prepare the store for Valentine's Day, Mrs. Osner came into the shop for the first time. Athena asked if she could help her.
"I need something to lift my spirits," Mrs. Osner said.
"How about something red?" Athena asked.
"I almost never wear red, but maybe you're right. Maybe I'm in a red mood."
She selected a lacy red nightgown and a matching peignoir to go over it.
"I'm a small," Mrs. Osner told Athena. "Do you have these in a small?"
"I'm sure we do," Athena said.
Then she called, "Christina," in her best voice, "can you find these in a small?" Christina stepped out from behind the curtain, separating the dressing rooms and the stock from the front shop.
"Oh, my goodness, Christina," Mrs. Osner said, surprised. "What are you doing here?"
"This is my mother's store," Christina explained. "My mother's and my sister's. Athena, this is Mrs. Osner, Dr. Osner's wife."
"I'm so glad to meet you," Athena said.
Mrs. Osner smiled.
"And I'm so glad you're carrying these elegant underpinnings. Saves me a trip to East Orange."
"Would you like to put something aside in case Dr. Osner comes in to shop for Valentine's Day?" Athena asked. "We're hosting a special night, for gentlemen only."
"I doubt Dr. Osner will be coming in to shop for Valentine's Day."
"I could drop a hint," Christina said.
"Yes, do that."
Mrs. Osner flipped through the nightgowns and held up a silky white one cut on the bias. And while she was at it, she chose half a dozen pairs of underpants, two bras, two half-slips, two full, and six pairs of stockings. By the time she was done, she'd spent a fortune, more than $100.
"When are you due?"
she asked, as Athena wrapped everything in tissue paper.
"Mid-May,"
Athena told her.
"Lovely. A spring baby.
My daughter Natalie was born in spring.
Is this your first?"
"No, I have a little boy. He's 2. He's home with my grandmother this morning."
"Well, Athena, you'll be seeing more of me. In fact, how about something for my daughter? She's almost 15. Something with hearts for Valentine's Day."
Athena showed her pajamas, white with tiny red hearts.
Perfect, Mrs. Osner said. Can you gift wrap it?
Of course, Athena said, trying not to show how thrilled she was by a new customer spending so much money all at once.
I'd better stop at Bob and Betty, too, Mrs. Osner said, and pick up something for Fern. She's too young for your shop. Maybe slippers with pom-poms.
She wrote a check for her purchases and signed it Corinne Mendelson Osner. Christina knew plenty about Mrs. Osner's bank accounts. The statements came to the office every month because Mrs. Osner was hopeless at balancing her checkbooks. Christina knew Mrs. Osner came from money. She could afford to buy whatever she wanted, whenever she wanted it. She didn't have to ask permission, like the other wives. She didn't have to save out of her household allowance every time she needed a new girdle. But Christina suspected the subject of money was often what led Dr. O to smashing one of the seven dwarves. Christina remembered the last bill from Fishman's, the most expensive women's dress shop in the city, and how, after Dr. O had seen it, he'd exploded, smashing not one, but two of the seven dwarves. Daisy hinted that every time the Osners had a spat, a shopping spree would follow. So, given what she'd just spent, Christina suspected a whopper. When Mrs. Osner left the shop, Athena said, "Very nice, Christina. You have the makings of an outstanding salesperson. You know how to present yourself. You know how to make helpful suggestions. Why not come to work here after graduation? We could be partners one day. I'm not saying right away, because I'm the one with the experience, but in time we could expand into accessories, scarves, gloves, bags."
"Thank you, Athena. I'll consider your offer."
But Christina had no intention of working with her mother and sister, especially not her sister. Christina didn't drop the hint about a Valentine's Day gift directly to Dr. O. Instead, she told Daisy that Mrs. Osner had put something away at Mia's lingerie in case Dr. O decided to go shopping. Daisy went to the shop on her own, bought the silky white nightgown for Corinne, and handed the gift-wrapped package to Dr. O the next day. "A little bird tells me this is what Corinne would like for Valentine's Day."
"Valentine's Day," Dr. O said. "Is it Valentine's Day already?"
"No, but it will be soon."
"Well, thanks, Daisy. It's very good of you to think of Corinne. Write yourself a check for the amount of the gift, and I'll sign it."
Elizabeth Daily Post. King George VI dies. British mourn wartime leader. Chapter 20. Mary. The King of England died on February 6th, and now Princess Elizabeth would be queen. She was 25 years old. Mary wondered how she felt, knowing she'd be queen for the rest of her life. Was she sad that her father died, but excited about being queen? Did she ever wish she were still a girl, a regular girl? Because Mary did. Sometimes she wished she were a little kid again. Everything was so simple then. Now she never knew when she was going to find out something terrible, something she didn't want to know. Sometimes her jaw ached in the morning. She wondered if Princess Elizabeth's jaw ever ached. She wasn't going to tell Rusty or anyone else about this. She wasn't going to tell that sometimes she tossed and turned all night. Sometimes she woke up tired. Life felt harder than it ever had before. Sometimes she felt angry, frustrated, often sad. She thought being in love could cure anything, but she was finding out that wasn't always true. She and Suzanne had chipped in to buy a big stuffed panda bear for Betsy Foster, but Suzanne's mother explained they couldn't visit her at the hospital. Betsy was still in isolation because of the burns. "Maybe in a few weeks," Mrs. Dietz had told them. Mary agreed to keep the panda, wrapped in cellophane, in her room. The problem was,
every time she looked at it, it reminded her of what had happened. She tried putting it in her closet on the shelf, but it didn't fit upright, so she laid it on its back. Which, in a way, was worse, because then it reminded her of Penny in a coffin. Finally, she set it on its belly and covered it with a spare blanket. And now, surprise, there was a letter from Mike Monsky. What was he thinking, writing a letter to her? She supposed she should be grateful he sent it in care of Frecky, and Frecky put it in a plain envelope and forwarded it to her. Still, what if Rusty saw it? What if Irene did?
Dear Miri, I'm back in Los Altos, and I've shown your photo, the one Frecky took of you in front of the paper mill playhouse, to Adela and the boys. All three are anxious to meet you, and hope you can visit over the summer. Yours, Dad, Mike Monk.
Dad? He had the guts to call himself Dad? And Adela wasn't surprised? She didn't get angry when she found out he had a secret child? Maybe she believed Mike Monk when he told her it was a surprise to him to learn he had a 15-year-old daughter. Maybe Adela believed whatever he told her. Or maybe they had a big fight over it. Maybe Adela accused him of being a liar. Liar, liar, pants on fire, the little boys would have sung, circling their father. Why did he have to go and write to her? Why couldn't he just leave her alone? But was that what she wanted, for him to leave her alone? She didn't know. She folded the letter into smaller and smaller squares, then shoved it into a sock. It could have been a piece of lint, toe jam in the bottom of her sock. Rusty would never bother to unroll a pair of socks. As far as Miri knew, Rusty never snooped around in her room. She was pretty sure Rusty trusted her. She was just covering all her bases. Today she had a morning appointment with Dr. O, and Rusty was going with her. "I need a pair of shoes," Rusty said. "And Dr. Osner said he'd fix my chipped tooth at the end of your appointment. Two birds with one stone." The shoe store, Kolber Sladkus, was next to Three Brothers Luncheonette on the street level of the Martin Building, where Dr. O had his office. While Rusty was trying on shoes, black suede pumps with 3-inch heels and a peep toe, on sale to make room for the spring line, Miri slipped her feet into the fluoroscope machine, where she peered into the viewfinder to see her bones, eerily green inside her shoes. Seeing her bones that way made her think of something from outer space. The boys at school were all walking around like zombies, with their arms outstretched, making the girls scream. Winky Herkovitz said a flying saucer was causing the planes to crash. You couldn't see it. It was hovering above Elizabeth, and when it wanted to cause a plane to crash, it did. What was it with the boys in her class? Was it that they liked the idea of spaceships and zombies? Was it too scary to think about what really made the planes crash? Rusty paraded around the shoe store in her peep-toe heels, admiring them in the mirror. "What do you think?" she asked Miri. "Nice," Miri said. "They're for dress, not work. I might leave them at the office for special occasions." How often did Rusty wear dress shoes? Maybe to the theater, maybe to a holiday party. Miri wasn't listening as Rusty went on about the shoes, until Rusty surprised her by asking, "How about it, honey? Would you like a new pair of shoes for Passover?" "Passover? That's not until April this year." "I know. But look at these patent leather sling bags. Aren't they cute?" Rusty was acting strange today, but if she was offering new shoes, Miri wasn't going to argue. Mrs. Kolber, who had fitted Miri for shoes as long as she could remember, brought out the sling bags for Miri to try. "They're expensive," Miri said, eyeing the price on the box. "You know what Nana says," Rusty told her. "They're your feet. You'll need them for the rest of your life. Treat them well." Irene was proud of her pretty, well-shaped, well-cared-for feet. She massaged them with Pond's cold cream every night. No bunions for her from wearing shoes that didn't fit. Mrs. Colbert didn't have to pad Irene's shoes, like she did with some of her friends, to make sure she'd be comfortable in her everyday Oxfords and her black pumps.
"You only live once," Mrs. Colbert sang.
That was probably how she got customers to shell out money for expensive new shoes. Mary got out of her saddle shoes, pulled off her thick white socks, and pulled on the pads Mrs. Colbert offered. When she slipped her feet into the new shoes and stood up, Mrs. Colbert pressed on her toes to see how close they came to the toe box, then told her to walk around to make sure she wasn't slipping out of the slingback. She'd never had slingback shoes. They made her feel like dancing. While the shoes were being wrapped, Rusty wrote a check to pay for them. Instead of biting her lip the way she usually did when it came to parting with money, she was humming to herself. She hummed in the elevator all the way to Dr. O's office on the third floor. Mary wasn't sure about this happy-go-lucky Rusty. It made her nervous. On the way down the hall, they passed the medical lab, and Mary poked her head in, the way she always did, to see the fat white rabbits in their cages. Natalie told her they had something to do with finding out if you were pregnant, something about urine was involved. But neither of them understood how it worked. Once, Mary had a blood test at the lab to see if she was anemic. She wasn't. In the waiting room of Dr. O's office, a little boy played with a small dog on the floor, while his mother sat on the sofa and leafed through a magazine. As soon as Mary entered, the dog ran to her.
"Fred!" Mary picked him up. "What are you doing here?"
"You know Fred?" the mother asked.
Her English was heavily accented, and she was good-looking, with big blue eyes, blonde baloney curls hanging down her back, big breasts, and just plump enough to make the boys whistle.
"Fred belongs to my friend Mason," Mary said, trying to talk slowly, pronouncing every syllable in every word, in case she didn't understand.
"Very nice boy, Mason. I know from Janet, always making us laugh. I'm Polina, and this my son, Stash."
"Oh, Polina." Mary got a pang, thinking that Mason was friends with her. Rusty looked up from the magazine she'd been flipping through.
"I'm Rusty Ammerman, and this is my daughter, Mary."
"Very nice meeting," Polina said.
"Mason told me you live," Mary began. "I mean, lived in one of the houses that was hit, but you were lucky because you weren't home."
"Very lucky. And lucky Miss Daisy took us home to stay. Miss Daisy's so wonderful, like a mother to us. But we need find new place to live."
"Maybe we can help," Rusty said. "We have a family friend who owns apartment buildings."
Mary looked over at Rusty. Was she talking about Ben Sapphire?
"Would be so good," Polina said.
"How did Fred get here?" Mary asked.
"Fred!"
Stash said, clapping his hands. Fred barked. The door to the inside office opened, and Christina stepped out.
"I'm sorry," she said, "but we can't allow pets in the office, not even in the waiting area."
"Fred!"
Stash said again, but Fred didn't bark this time.
"I know it's Fred," Christina said, "but even Fred can't be in the waiting room. It's against the rules."
Polina stood up.
"Come, Stash, we take Fred for walk now."
She turned to Christina.
"Please tell Miss Daisy we come back later for ride home."
To Rusty, she said,
"Very nice meet you."
And to Mary,
"Very nice meet you, too."
Before Mary could say anything else, Christina ushered her into the office.
"We're ready for you, Mary."
Christina was professional around her. She clipped on the white towel over the cape and prepared the little pleated paper cup.
How did they get the pleats into the paper? Miri wondered. Was it someone's job, or was there a machine that did it? How come she'd never seen pleated cuffs anywhere but at Dr. O's office? She supposed other dentists also used them, but she'd never been to any other dentist. Christina poured a small amount of Lavoris mouthwash into the cup. Miri rinsed and spit before Dr. O came in, asking,
"How's my favorite patient?"
He probably said that to everyone, but Miri liked hearing it anyway. He began to poke around in her mouth, with Christina assisting.
"What music would you like to hear today, Miss Mirabelle?"
Dr. O could whistle any tune, from the top 40 to classical. Miri thought he'd surely win if he went on Arthur Godfrey's talent show. "Surprise me," Miri told him. And he did, whistling "How High the Moon." Miri relaxed, closed her eyes, and thought of Mason. She cringed a couple of times during the drilling of the small cavity, but it wasn't that bad. Just as Dr. O promised, she didn't need Novocaine. When the tooth was filled and Miri had rinsed, Dr. O said,
"So, how are you doing, Mirabelle?"
"Okay."
"Not worried about anything?"
"What would I worry about?" "Only everything." Was he going to ask her about Natalie? And if so, what would she tell him?
"Does your jaw ever ache in the morning?"
"Sometimes." How did he know? "Please don't tell my mother if I have a terrible disease."
"Looks like you're grinding your teeth."
"Grinding?"
"Understandable, given what you've been through. We can make you a device to wear at night to prevent the clenching and grinding."
"What kind of device?"
"Just something that fits over your teeth."
"Suppose I don't want a device?"
"Grinding can damage your teeth."
"Damage?"
"We carry anxiety in different ways."
"Anxiety?"
"Tell you what, we'll recheck in a month to see how you're doing. Okay with you, Miss Mirabelle?"
"Okay."
"Good."
He smiled at her.
"How come I haven't seen you around our house lately?"
"I was there on the day of... on the day of..."
"Yes, I know."
He paused.
"Well, I don't want to spoil Natalie's surprise. She'll want to tell you herself. She's in New York today, at dance class."
"But I'll see her tonight at bowling."
"Since when does Nat bowl?"
"She's our scorekeeper." Natalie couldn't take the chance of dropping a ball or having someone else drop a ball on her foot.
"Ah, the scorekeeper,"
Dr. O said. At the bowling alley that night, Mason was tender, making sure her shoes fit, squeezing to check for enough toe room, just like Mrs. Colbert, choosing exactly the right bowling ball for her weight. She'd always been hopeless at bowling, but now, with a few pointers from Mason, she was improving. Robo was the best in their group, gliding to the line, right foot behind her left, with a follow-through every time. Miri was paying attention to Robo's form, keeping a picture of Robo in her mind when it was her turn, and it was starting to pay off. But soon, Robo would be moving, and Miri would have to find someone else to follow. When Mason stopped by their station, he ruffled Miri's hair, making the other girls sigh. Mason called her new haircut cute, but Miri knew he didn't really like it. She assured him it would grow quickly, an inch a month, she'd heard, and just to be sure, she'd already started to gently tug it, the way she did a pair of dungarees that had shrunk in the wash. She expected to be halfway there by summer, by the time of Henry and Leah's wedding. She was waiting until invitations went out to ask if she could invite Mason to be her date. Mason pointed to a barrel-chested man bowling in the next lane.
"Joey Politics," he said. "He knows everybody and everything."
The girls looked over for a minute, but really, what did they care about somebody called Joey Politics? She told Mason about meeting Polina at Dr. O's office. "My mother's going to ask Ben Sapphire if he can find her and Stosh a place to live."
That'd be good.
And just like that, he leaned in and kissed her, the first time they'd kissed in public, in front of Suzanne, Eleanor, Robo, and Natalie. Then he kissed her again, until his boss called,
"Enough, lover boy. You got a line waiting for shoes, and I need a pin boy in lane 6.
The girls teased her, humming the wedding march.
"Have you set the date yet?"
Robo asked.
"Stop!"
Miri shouted, louder than she'd meant to, and they laughed, all but Natalie.
"It's freezing in here," Natalie said, wrapping a wool scarf around her neck.
She was swathed in sweaters and had her coat draped over her shoulders.
"If you bowled, you'd be boiling,"
Suzanne told her, stripping down to a cotton shirt with her name embroidered across the pocket, like the ladies who played in leagues. Miri threw her first strike that night, which she took as a sign that every day something good can happen. And today was a bonanza, new shoes, Mason's kisses, and a strike. Later, before Eleanor's father picked them up, Natalie took her aside.
"Come to my house tomorrow morning. I have something to show you."
"Is it the surprise your father talked about?"
"He told you about the surprise?"
"Only that you have one.
So what is it?"
"If I tell you, it won't be a surprise. And don't say anything to the other girls, okay? I'm not ready to tell them yet." Miri remembered the last time she'd gone to Natalie's, just her, and it turned out to be the worst day of her life. The surprise was the finished basement. It had been transformed into a dance studio with a mirrored wall, a bar, and a wood floor. The jukebox still stood in the corner, but instead of Nat King Cole and Patti Page, it held the kind of music you hear in movie musicals. "Blue skies, smiling at me."
"Isn't it fabulous?"
Natalie asked.
"The floor is genuine maple, the best for tap."
She hummed and did a couple of warm-up steps, then stopped and looked at Miri.
"Say something."
"All the furniture is gone." Miri knew that wasn't what Natalie wanted to hear, but she couldn't hide her disappointment.
"That's it?"
Natalie asked, annoyed.
"No, I mean, it's great, but..."
"But what?"
"I'll miss the parties."
This is where she and Mason met and danced for the first time. She'd been hoping Natalie would host another get-together soon, maybe for Valentine's Day.
"We can still have parties," Natalie said. "The furniture is in the garage. Daddy and Steve can bring it back in any time. Not that I have time for parties these days."
Natalie pulled off one sweater, then another, and tossed them across the room. She stepped out of her dungarees and kicked them to the corner. Then she stood in front of the mirrored wall, in her long-sleeved black leotard, black tights, white little girl socks trimmed in lace, and black tap shoes with small heels and a Mary Jane strap. It had been ages since Miri had seen her without layers of clothing. The size of her took Miri's breath away.
"Why are you staring that way?" Natalie asked.
"What way?"
"Like you're in shock."
"Well, I am, sort of. You're so thin."
"I know. Isn't it great? Ruby's been coaching me. I eat green grapes and drink a ton of water. Dancers have to stay hydrated."
Natalie posed. First position, second position, fifth position.
"You know what I see when I look in the mirror?"
Miri was almost afraid to hear her say it.
"I see Ruby."
She didn't wait for Miri's reaction.
"I'm never alone now. She's given me the greatest gift a person can give. She's given me her life."
Miri felt something roiling inside her. She looked away, angry at Natalie for not eating, angry for acting crazy, angry for throwing away their friendship. But she was scared, too. Scared there was something really wrong with her. Scared that she and Natalie would never be friends again. That they'd never know what the other was thinking. That Natalie would never rest her head in Miri's lap while they watched television. Inseparable. That's what everyone said about them back in seventh grade. Come back, she wanted to shout. Come back and be my friend.
Natalie misunderstood Miri's expression.
You're jealous of Ruby? Why would I be jealous of Ruby? She's dead.
She's not dead, Natalie said. Why can't you understand? Why won't you even try?
I don't like the way she's changed you.
You've changed, too, since Mason. And just so you know, you're not the only one in love. I'm in love with this, with dance. Dance is my life. There is nothing else.
Yes, there is. There's school, and friends, and your family. Some people would give anything for your family.
Natalie shook her head. You don't know anything. Miri didn't like the way Natalie said that, as if maybe there was something Natalie knew that she didn't. It hurt to think she had a secret she couldn't share with Miri. Not that Miri had shared her secret about Mike Monsky, but there was a difference between having a secret no one suspected and having one you dropped hints about, wasn't there?
Maybe you should tell your parents about Ruby, Miri said. Maybe they can help.
Help? I don't need help. I've never been happier.
She pressed the play button, and the jukebox came to life. She snapped her fingers a few times and began to tap as Judy Garland's voice sang, "Forget your troubles. Come on, get happy." She tapped across the room and back, then paused, looked at Miri, and smiled a smile Miri didn't recognize. A hard smile. Maybe it was Ruby's, maybe not. But it sent shivers down Miri's spine. She took a couple of slow turns around the floor, then began to turn faster and faster until she was spinning, spinning like some kind of whirling dervish right out of their social studies book.
Stop! Miri called. Stop!
But Natalie didn't stop. Her eyes glazed over as she twirled faster and faster until her face turned almost purple. Miri ran upstairs, found Dr. O and Corinne in the kitchen eating bagels.
What is it?
Corinne asked, reading Miri's face.
Natalie, Miri said.
They both jumped up and followed Miri downstairs, where Natalie was still spinning to Judy Garland.
Get ready for the judgment day.
Miri pressed the off button on the jukebox. The room fell silent, except for Natalie's taps. Dr. O grabbed her.
Natalie, sweetheart.
He lifted her into his arms.
My God, she's light as a feather, he said to Corinne.
Natalie's feet kept moving. Somewhere she, or Ruby, was still tapping.
Call Harry Reese, Dr. O said to Corinne.
Dr. Reese was a doctor, but also their friend. He was at their New Year's Eve party in the conga line.
It's Sunday, Corinne said.
Call him at home,
Dr. O said.
No.
Call him, Corinne, or I'm taking her straight to the hospital.
You have no idea what's going on in this house, Arthur. You're too busy solving everyone else's problems to see that your son is in despair and your daughter is losing her mind. You think giving her a dance studio at home is going to fix this? She swept her arm around the room.
Don't you see?
Corinne began to cry.
I'm utterly alone. I don't even have Mrs. Barnes to help, and she's never coming back.
You have friends.
I wouldn't tell my friends one word about what's happening to us. Not one word.
Miri didn't want to hear this. Didn't want to witness the end of the perfect family, the end of her fantasies. Now Natalie was slumped against her father like a rag doll. Miri snuck up the stairs and out the back door, while Corinne's and Dr. O's voices rose and fell and rose again. She rode her bike home and collapsed into Irene's arms.
What's wrong, sweetie pie?
Irene asked, holding her. And for once, she didn't ask any more questions.
There's plenty to do and plenty to see wherever you go in Florida. From the Northwest tip to the Romantic Keys, you'll find infinite variety. That's why so many thousands come down and enjoy the glorious sunshine, outdoor sports, and scenic wonders. Get in the national habit. Fly National Airlines, airline of the stars. Finest aircraft, finest service.
Chapter 21. Gabby. Gabby Wenders always wanted to fly. She'd wave to the planes as they flew across the wide-open fields behind her grandmother's house on their approach to Vandalia Airport between Dayton and Springfield, imagining the exciting lives of the passengers inside the silver ship, all of them rich and good-looking, all of them dressed in the stylish travel clothes she'd seen in her older sister's fashion magazines. At 13, she'd stand in front of the mirror and practice.
"Welcome aboard, ladies and gentlemen," she would say in her new, well-modulated voice. "I am your lovely and perfectly groomed air hostess, Miss Gabrielle Wenders. Your pilot today is Scotty Champion."
She'd smile ever so slightly, her fingertips touching the silver wings on the lapel of her suit jacket. Captain Scotty Champion would be so handsome, the female passengers would swoon at the sight of him. She might marry Scotty Champion someday, but not for many years, at least three, because she'd worked hard for her career and wasn't about to give it up for marriage. In high school, Gabby sent away for a brochure. She'd memorized it in the first week, but she still liked to see it in print before closing her eyes at night. Girls wanted to enter Flight Stewardess Training Group. Here is the career opportunity for which you have been waiting. If you are interested and feel that you can meet all of the qualifications below, please write in detail and attach a full-length photograph. Height, between 5'2 and 5'6. Weight, 135 pounds maximum. Attractive, just below Hollywood standards. Plenty of personality and poise. Gender, female. Marital status, single, not divorced, separated, or widowed. Race, white. Age, 21 to 26 years old. Education, registered nurse or 2 years of college. Vision, 20/20 without glasses. Must be a U.S. citizen and available for training within 6 months. If you feel you qualify. If, Gabby thought, come on. She qualified with a capital Q. To get her parents' blessing, she showed them a line in a magazine about how being a stewardess was a career for wives in training. She knew they'd approve of that. Getting her RN degree at the local hospital took 2 years, and Gabby worked for a year after that until she could apply, which she did on her 21st birthday. At the time, she was still living at home with her parents and her younger brothers, her older sister long married, with 4-year-old twins, another on the way, and a husband who operated a forklift. They lived in a little white house near her grandmother's place.
"You'll be able to wave to me," she told her young nieces, "the way I used to wave to the planes." "Will you wave back?" one of the girls asked. "Of course I will."
Gabby chose National Airlines, in part because she'd read that American received 20,000 applications the year before for just 347 stewardess positions. Not that she doubted her qualifications, not for a minute, but Gabby went for National anyway and was accepted, the only applicant out of 29 being interviewed on the same day. She was jubilant. Hard work and a positive attitude paid off. She'd been careful about dating after high school, not wanting to get serious with some local boy who'd expect her to give up her dreams for his, produce 2 babies, preferably one of each sex, wear an apron over her shirtwaist dress, and have dinner on the table every night at 6 p.m. No, thank you. There was a young doctor at the hospital, but he was almost as dangerous as the others. If she confided her dream to him, he'd drop her like a hot potato. Still, she went out with him, not that he had much time off. but she never told her mother. And sometimes, when their breaks coincided, they'd get into his car and kiss until the windows steamed up. She'd